Welcome to the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. I'm Dr. Chris Tucker from the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center and the podcast founding editor. Today, we are discussing the use of virtual reality in orthopedic surgery training. I'm joined today by Dr. Gus Mazzocca, Medical Director of Mass General Brigham Sports Medicine. Dr. Mazzocca was an author on the article titled, Head-Mounted Display Virtual Reality is Effective in Orthopedic Training, a Systematic Review, published in the October 2023 issue of the Arthroscopy Journal. Gus, congrats on your work and welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you, Chris.
Gus, the theme for this month's ANA newsletter and our current CME podcast episode is emerging technology. So I'm excited to discuss with you this topic of head-mounted virtual reality and how it plays into our surgery training. But first, could you just introduce yourself a little bit? Tell us about yourself and your practice and your areas of interest in orthopedic surgery.
Sure. Trained medical school at the University of Connecticut. My father was an art professor at the University of Connecticut. I did my residency at the University of Connecticut, then did a fellowship at Rush with Dr. Bach, Romeo, Cole, Bush, Joseph, Nicholson, and then came back and started working at the University of Connecticut. Worked my way up to become chairman, then had a little issue with the dean, and then I moved here to Mass General Brigham to be the medical director and then the chief of sports medicine at Mass General Hospital. From a research interest, we call it the three-headed monster. So interested in cell biology and how different biological substances can enact and try to help heal, kind of the body's ability to try to heal, specifically when it comes to bone tendon healing. Then moving into biomechanics, cadaver biomechanics, where we look at ways to make certain processes stronger, more resilient, so that we can decrease the amount of rehab time and get people back faster. And then outcomes, which looks at all of those two items, the biology and the mechanics, in real life to see how people are doing and progressing. Education's always been very near and dear to my heart. The residency and fellowship at the University of Connecticut. I'm lucky enough now to be able to help a little bit with the fellows here at Mass General and then some of our residents. So those are my...
That's wonderful. I think your experience, especially with your research efforts and also your experience with teaching and training residents, fellows, you know, for many years, lends itself to having a great perspective for this discussion. On a personal note, I remember visiting with you back during the ANA Traveling Fellowship in 2017 when we visited UConn and had the opportunity to come see you in the operating room. And so that was a personal highlight for that trip for me. So I appreciate you coming full circle and joining me on the podcast now to talk about education as well. So on to our topic at hand, emerging technology in orthopedics. To better frame our discussion, let's first talk about this larger picture of orthopedic surgery training in general. I think we're all familiar with Dr. William Halstead's famous traditional method of see one, do one, teach one. However, that fairly simple summary of an approach to training has some contemporary critiques, especially in the face of patient safety concerns and the ACGME resident work hour changes that were instituted back in 2003 and again in 2011. Could you share with us your thoughts on resident training in general, your approach, and what you've seen evolve over the last few decades?
Yeah, I think probably, and this almost dovetails into our next thing, but I think one thing that's really important is it happens a lot also in coaching, but you have to understand your athlete or your resident, and they're different. Some are very skilled in three-dimensional ability, and some are not. And it doesn't mean that one's better than the other, but you have to understand where they're lacking and where they're good so that you can kind of concentrate and work on that. And I think sometimes in training programs, we treat everybody the same, right? We want to make sure that they have the whole same experience and everybody gets the same training, but it may not be the best way. So I think that's probably one of the biggest things that that I've learned, and it really became much more apparent to me when we started working a little bit with that VR. I would say that the concern with the amount of reps that people get now because of the work hour decrease is an issue for a group, right? So the group that needs more time or more reps doing something actually gets hurt by that. So there's a certain amount of work that, you know, residents do in their training, but there's a certain amount of reps they get in the OR, depending on the attending that's working with them, how patient that attending is, how much training is going on, and, you know, how much confidence the attending has in the resident to execute what they're doing. So I think that's a bigger issue, and that's a huge variable that we don't really speak about that much. It also becomes, it can go full circle on somebody. So if you're not as good and you need more reps, instead of getting more reps in the OR, you actually get less reps because people are less confident in you and they're going to give you one or two shots and then they're going to take over. There's also a lot of pressure on faculty now to become more clinically productive, which means that the amount of time to discuss and work on small little things in the OR is cut less. That's put a bigger impact on outside of the OR surgical skills development. And how do you do that? How do you do that in a cost-effective way? How do you do that where they're actually practicing and you know what they're doing? And those are all kind of the issues. But I think really trying to understand and work with residents at an early time, speaking to them and trying to really let them open up on what they feel that they do well and what they feel they don't do well, letting them know that that's okay. With stuff that they worry about, that they don't do well, and then trying to work on that in whatever way you can. There's all different ways. There's, you know, educators are terrific. People that are dedicated to education, you know, really will kind of think up things and do different things based on their own experiences to try to help people, which, you know, and I think that, you know, the basis of education is, everybody loves education when it's easy. It's when it's hard that the real educators start to have to rise up. And I think that's something that we need to recognize a little bit as well.
Yeah, I love your approach to the individualization of your teaching. You know, these ACGME work hour restrictions, like you mentioned, certainly imposed an external limit on the patient contact hours that trainees are getting. And it was interesting because despite the proposed risk to patient safety of overworked residents, which sparked the work hour restrictions, multiple studies have shown since then no actual effect on patient outcome improvement with the more flexible resident work hours. But what has been shown is that the resident work hour restrictions are limiting trainees' time in the operating room. So obviously that leverages the need for these outside the operating room experiences, like you mentioned. I was just curious to know, outside of virtual reality, which we're going to get to, what's been your experience with other simulation modes to supplement resident surgical training? You know, things like cadaver models or plastic models or knot tying apparatuses. What's been your experience with all that sort of stuff pre-VR?
I think that when you identify where you may be weak, the problem with all of those things is as a resident, you're rotating through multiple services. So to have models that mimic all the different services these kids are rotating through usually doesn't happen. And in the framework of, say, a cadaver lab, there are certain labs that are there, but it may be out of cycle. You may be on pediatrics, doing spines when the, you know, the multi-league cadaver lab happens. Those all sound good, but really I think trying to have individualized practice on skills that the learners may not be good at, I think is really one of the most important things. So models, absolutely. You know, working with the arthroscopic knot pusher for arthroscopic surgery, you know, being able to tie square knots very quickly, sliding knots, knowing what knot your surgeon wants you to use, and then being able to do that, that will allow, residents to be able to do a lot more. If the surgeon sees you throwing knots that are good, then they'll be happy to let you tie the knots. You know what I mean? I think that's one thing that happens. I think also in a lot of times in complex cases, as opposed to just kind of sitting out, helping, retracting, or watching, as you work with an attending, you can actually ask to do a part of the case. So say, you know what, like this is, you know, for this ACL or for this rotator cuff, the one thing I want to work on is passing the sutures through the tendon. No problem, right? So now I can do whatever I have to do. Then they can work and we can spend 10 minutes passing the sutures, talking about that, and then go back. Sometimes that takes the pressure off of a faculty member that may not be as confident. And the reason why I know that is that's me, right? I'm not that confident in there. So it's harder for me to let somebody go for a long time. So I'm not like a great surgical educator in the OR for high-level residents or fellows. I'm much better with the more junior people, only because of that. But I think that exists in a lot of realm. So if you're a resident that may sense that, I think one thing you can do is do part of the case or talk about part of the case where, hey, you know, I'm here, I'm watching, I'm happy, but how about this? How about me getting into the shoulder? You know, spend 10 minutes, let me get into the shoulder, do a diagnostic and then go. And then after that, then I want to do this. So you can divide up the case into the parts. And then sometimes that allows you to work on those parts that you feel you're weak at, right? So a lot of people get in the shoulder, do a diagnostic. We don't have to spend time doing that, but I want to definitely pass the suture and tie the knots. All right, that's what we're going to concentrate on. So that allows the case to go faster. But the part where the resident really needs to concentrate and learn those skills, then we can spend a little bit more time there. And I think that's one thing that I've tried to develop a little bit. You know, there's some unbelievable surgical educators that can let people go and they can really train them while they go and they can do the whole case. And those obviously are the best.
You know, Gus, I think your comments are very insightful, where you're recognizing your own limitations in educating. And so not only is the education individualized to the trainee, but it's also individualized to the surgeon. And like you said, these residents are rotating amongst many different surgeons on various different services, and they're getting around the world exposure to a lot of different personalities and styles. But if you as the educator can be at least introspective enough to know how you're best teaching, I think that lends itself to that, you know, the best possible educator-trainee relationship. Your experience with kind of dividing up the case and asking the resident about what they want to work on mirrors my own. You know, I've been faculty at Walter Reed for 15 years now. And in the beginning, I think I was a little bit all over the place as a new staff, kind of letting them do as much as they could do or setting a time limit and then cutting them off. But like you said, a lot of people end up getting really good at the diagnostic scope that way, but then the latter parts of the case, they may not have that hands-on experience. So I'm doing now what you're doing. I talk to the residents ahead of time and I say, hey, let's have a focused plan. What do you want to work on today? And just like you said, for rotator cuff, they may say, hey, you know, I'm comfortable with the diagnostic, I'm comfortable with everything, but I really want to work on this technique of passing sutures or whatever. And then it helps move through the day and they get out of it what they want to get out of it. So, you know, I applaud your, you know, kind of introspection to kind of recognize how to best train based on your personality, as well. You know, that being said, I wanted to move on to talking about this new technology, the head mounted display virtual reality, which your paper was on. Could you just talk to us about just what it is, how it works, what it offers to surgeons and trainees, and just what's going on there?
Yeah, so that's a great question. How it works, I don't know. It's magic. But I will say this, is a head-mounted Google glasses or whatever type of glasses you have. It's very interesting to me the first time you put them on. I think the TV commercials for it don't do it justice, because your brain really adapts quite quickly to the virtual area. And that was really interesting to me from the very beginning. Like you, really, your mind assimilates to the virtual world that you're in, even though you're standing in a room with a weird headset on, and you know, two joysticks in your hands. You can see your hands. You start moving your hands. They work. You know, so it is really. I think from that aspect, it's definitely an emerging technology in the fact that it's just going to get better. You know, I joke that, you know, I went through, you know, my life where the internet was, you know, computers didn't really exist except, you know, at NASA. And, you know, we started with, you know, phones and beepers, and then the beepers went to text beepers. And then there was a BlackBerry, and now there's a phone that you can watch live sports on. So, you know, that technology is gone. This technology will also mimic it. They'll have a certain number of platforms. The one I do is Precision OS. Danny Gould was a fellow here at MGH, a shoulder surgeon, and he is really kind of the CEO of this company, which is really a forward-thinking company, and they you know, are working on all aspects of it. It was funny because I don't think their business model wanted to concentrate on necessarily medical student and resident education. But the minute I got my hands on it, it's the perfect thing for that. You know, I think it's really because, Chris, the biggest thing is it's practice. So like we were talking about before, going through a case, that's really kind of a game day situation, right? Like you're a human being and it's got to work and you have to do it in a certain amount of time. And the longer you spend, the shoulder will blow up. Things can start to go wrong. So it's not, we call it practice, but it shouldn't be. The VR allows you to practice. And it's one of the, even in a cadaver lab, you can't really practice. And by practice, I mean doing the same thing 25 times, you know, doing it, then back to the beginning, doing it again, back to the beginning. In cadaver lab, you can do it once, and then we can talk about the anatomy and we can kind of do some stuff, but you really can't repeat the same thing multiple times on a cadaver. But there's some things you can't, but in the VR world, you can do whatever part of the case or however you want to do it multiple times. Plus, it also allows you to see in three-dimensional a lot of different, you know, aspects. I know in this, in the specific one that we use at the University of Connecticut, they had a SCIFI module, which I like because, you know, when you pin a SCIFI, it's a different direction than when you're doing, say, an inotrope. So that's where we really started getting on to the idea of practice and what, when you look at the x-ray and you put your hand with the pin, how are you adjusting your hand to make sure that your entry hole and exit are going in the same direction? And that's when this whole idea of practicing really started to come about. Because what the VR will allow you to do from an educational standpoint is it's called casting. So they'll have a plug that goes from their goggles onto my laptop. So for the first time, you actually look through the eyes of the trainee. Hmm. Most of the time, you're doing an inotrope, you're doing a pinning, whatever. You're looking at the x-ray, you're looking at the resident, you're looking at whatever you need for as long as you need to look at it. With the VR, you're looking through the resident's eyes, which is really unique because then all of a sudden, like maybe you don't see the x-ray or maybe you don't see it for as long as you think you should. And now they're looking at their hands and you can start to see things much differently, especially in kind of your, you know, your average technician. So this is where this whole idea of three-dimensional ability comes. And there are some surgeons that have great three-dimensional ability. And there's some that don't, those of us that don't really know it, but we don't advertise it that much. But we went through a lot of things where, you know, Bob Arciero, who you know, he has unbelievable three-dimensional ability. I have average to poor three-dimensional ability. No, but this is important because there's a lot of tests out there, especially for the military. You may be aware of them, where they look at that spatial awareness, three-dimensional ability. We took a lot of those tests together. And any time that we were close, I knew that that had poor content validity, which nobody knew, right? We would talk to the people. But there's a lot of this going on. You know, the sport gaming crew is really looking at a lot of this as well. The bottom line, it's a long answer for your question, but I think really the key part of virtual reality from an educational standpoint is this ability to cast, where you look through your trainees' eyes as they execute whatever process they're doing, which is an incredibly unique perspective and gives you a lot of insight on areas that they may not know they're struggling in, where they are struggling.
So you and your co-authors set out to determine the efficacy of this head-mounted display VR for orthopedic surgery training through your systematic review. Can you just talk me through the methodologies of what you encountered in the 8 studies you ended up including, just in terms of how training programs were implementing the use of the VR? What types or kinds of skills or cases were they teaching? And then what skills of the trainees were they evaluating? Because I'm curious to know, you know, what level of proficiency was being achieved and if there was some sort of ceiling effect. You know, basically you can, if there was a limit to the type of skill that they could train, was it just really good at teaching novices or was there room for improvement even in fairly experienced skilled surgeons?
Yeah, well, this is this was a systematic review of kind of what other people had published. And really the bottom line behind it is, yes, it can, much like any type of training, can show improvements. So my opinion is that although for, you know, a certain type of skill, and in those papers, they went over, you know, different things. Some did total hips, some did reverse shoulder arthroplasty, tibial IM nails, glenoid exposure. How I think it happened where people that knew about VR, interested in VR, had seen it VR, had their kids with a VR, then were like, hey, that looks neat. I wonder if we can do it. Then would relate it to whatever software they could get and then look at that in a training program, right? So you could go with experts and residents. You could go with medical students to medical students to residents. You could go to medical students to experts. So they were all, it was a mixed match of all of those different types of techniques, just seeing if it would show an improvement. I think lost in all of this is one, the technology. So no question that the more you practice anything, the better you're going to get. And as the technology starts to advance more, it'll definitely be able to help people do more complex cases. I think one area that they're really working on developing is being able to download CT scans, having that three-dimensional model in the virtual world so that you can then work on reduction techniques before you go into the case. You can then look at some screw angles and positions to see how that's going to go to prepare for your case. Those are like in complex, say, distal humerus fractures or something, which I think will be amazing. From an educational standpoint, I think the idea of identifying basic skills that we kind of want our PGY1 and 2 residents to do, having a platform that they can then practice that on, I imagine it's in the works, but you know, the system that I used had a great module, like I said, on intertrochanteric fracture, and Skivvy. I liked keeping those. They also had the reverse shoulder arthroplasty. They had a total knee revision. So I don't want to minimize anything that they're doing, but I liked those two modules for first and second year residents because you are taking a pin, you're looking at an x-ray, you're putting that pin on the bone and you're trying to put it into a certain place and have it exit at a certain area. And it's two different angles. It's two different ways to do it. And that with the casting, you'd be able to see kind of, you know, how people would either struggle or not struggle, how many x-rays, you know. I had Bob Arciero, who was doing, you know, hip fractures back in the 1700s. And he would be like, in those days, you know, you'd put a pin in and you'd get a flat plate. You'd have to wait for the guy to develop it and come back and show you where you were. Now we have, you know, C-arms where, you know, we just walk the pin into where we think it would, like 10 to 15 quick shots, right? And we've gotten a little lazy on how we can position our hands. And I think that really starts to develop that three-dimensional ability. And there are some residents that have unbelievable three-dimensional ability and are very good, and then they advance. The ones that don't have it doesn't mean they can't advance, but they just need more practice. And I think that's where, in the educational standpoint, where I have the passion, because I think that's a really unique opportunity from a very early time where you can identify those trainees and then really concentrate on them and then bring them up so they don't get left behind slowly, right? There's an insidious process that can happen when you're not, say, the best resident and you're in the bottom resident and you don't get that many reps because everybody will take over because they know that you kind of struggle, right? And now you do less and less. So instead of having more practice, you actually have less practice, but you're not harmful. You're not terrible. And that becomes an issue as well. So now you have to go out. Now you go to your fellowship. And then that's where they discover that there's these deficiencies, or worse, now you go into practice where those deficiencies are discovered. So I think that would be really a really important area for us to concentrate on, where we can really help these kids practice areas that they may be weak on. And it's not everybody, but there's a significant amount of people out there that can use practice for those things. And the last part is, as that technology gets better, you'll see whenever you do a skill, especially when somebody's watching you and you don't do it well, there's a lot of excuses you can give, right? So there's this concept of haptics, which is the feel, right? So VRs, I don't know if they're struggling, but they work on it, right? Like, no one likes the feel of VR. You can't feel it so well, the vibration, whatever. The haptics are not, you know, no one's wowing about the haptics on VR. But I also think sometimes that's kind of an excuse for us when we're not executing well. And I can see that, you know, there's some people that can handle, you know, not doing something well and understand that they need to practice it more. And there's some people that can't handle that. And I think that's a really important area to have. And it's also a really unique time where you and a resident are kind of connected. You know, like, I'm watching the monitor on the laptop and they're next to it doing it, you know, and I enjoyed it. It takes a lot of time. So it's probably, you know, it's not something that everybody can do all the time. The idea would be the resident would be able to practice it on our own. But I think the residents, in my experience, like accomplishing the whole case, you know, and they want to do the whole case. They don't want to practice the areas that they're bad at. Like, who the heck wants to do that? So they'll go through the case and then they'll check it off and then they're good, right? Now they practiced. But when you're casting with them, you can just make them repeat it. Do it again, which of course is not great for them. They're not so enthralled by it, but I think it makes them better.
Absolutely. I think you highlighted a number of the advantages of the VR. You know, when I looked at your review in detail, as you mentioned, the studies that have been done on using VR for education really do span a fairly broad spectrum of procedures. Like you said, you know, you enjoy using it for training things like hip pinning and Skiffy, because it's that tactile, three-dimensional space skill. But I also saw studies that you reviewed of, you know, general techniques like IM nails, glenoid exposure, which is really more about kind of, you know, soft tissue management and exposure more than like a drill or a you know, pin position. And then, you know, start to finish cases like total hips and reverse total shoulders. And one of the things I observed, which was almost uniform across the 8 studies, I think one or two of them did not show, was that not only were people's skills getting better, but it was really the time to completion that improved as well. And so, you know, there was a uni total knee study of residents and med students on sawbones, and they actually showed no difference in the kind of performance of the tasks, but their time to completion was significantly improved with the VR training versus traditional methods. And I think that was a theme throughout. There was, you know, the time to completion was better in tibial nails. Time to completion was faster with glenoid exposure. So not only were the trainees getting the skills correct, but they were doing it faster as well. And maybe that has to do with that, you know, lifelike third person visualization and the repetition. But I think that's interesting to note that that was one of the takeaways from your review. I don't know if you noticed that as well. When you see your trainees in the OR after using this technology, do they seem more confident? Do they seem faster at the procedures they've practiced?
Yeah, I imagine they did. At UConn, you know, we were on call much less. So you'd be working with them and then they'd be on call with other people. So we would ask around and that, you know, so we never had that direct, you know, that direct, but no question that could be it. The other thing that hasn't been developed to my knowledge yet, which I think will be fabulous, is being able to throw in complications. Now we can train complications, which is an extremely important part of surgical education and is absolutely random. Thank God. But, you know, just like the pilots train, we'll be able to train. And then theoretically, you know, I could be taking you through a reverse shoulder and then we get into, you know, significant bleeding. Now, what are we doing? How do we find it? What you know what I mean? And now we can train those residents to be able to handle that situation, know they've been there before, have great confidence. And I think that will really be a big improvement in surgical training is the simulation of different types of complications that we worry about. And then we can all, and as a group of educators, we can all bring them together. Like, here, I had this complication. You'd never believe this happened to me. This is what I did. So all those solutions can also be put in there so that the educators can be, right? Like, I may not know all the possible issues, but we would have that for us so that we could throw those in and then see those scenarios and then work them out. I think that'll be a really big thing that's absolutely coming.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful insight. I mean, that's kind of like having a virtual M&M, you know, which we try and utilize as a training tool for our program. But like you said, if a resident doesn't happen to be in the room for the M&M for the complication that happens once every 3 years, they're not going to glean the knowledge from that. But now, boom, plug it in and make them go through it.
Yeah.
What a wonderful potential advantage. So we have talked a lot about the benefits and the advantages of VR. I was just wondering if we could at least speak briefly about some of the potential drawbacks that you've seen. I know you already mentioned the haptics kind of lagging behind in their development, which obviously can be improved. Are there any other drawbacks you see to VR? You know, things sort of like cost or availability or how to use it? You know, anything else that's potentially not ideal about it right now?
I'll liken it to the evolution from the beeper to the smartphone, right? Like, it's going to get better. So, yeah, when they were looking at that soft tissue exposure, you know, that's not as lifelike as you want. And that's probably why I gloss over it. No question that you can kind of go through those. But really, when it's talking about, you know, doing an open shoulder, it's when you don't, or you don't have the visualization that you want. And what are the tricks you do to get that visualization? That's not been really recreated in the VR world yet. You know, it's kind of standard. You kind of go down, the soft tissues move, you know, you have to identify them and stuff, but you go fairly quickly and easily. You're not running into a stiff shoulder that you can't dislocate. You know what I mean? Like, you're not running into where you can't see the back half of the glenoid and what are you going to do and why that is or what you're worried about. So I think as that technology develops, it'll get better. The issue, I think, from the business side of it is they need more money and investment because the computer programs and the programs that are doing this costs a lot and it's a tremendous amount of time. And like I said, I don't think any of these VR platforms thought that resident education or surgical training would be the way to go. I do think that it's going to be a great advantage for, you know, the third world surgeons that don't have the ability to fly to watch somebody or to go to a conference or to see all the videos, but where they would be able to get that. And then, you know, I know Dr. Warner has done a lot of this where you'll be able to be in the virtual OR together. So the surgeon and the expert can be there together, talking, communicating in that virtual environment, going through a case. And that's another huge advantage, which I think, you know, not only will help medical students, residents, and fellows, but also all of us, you know, as we start doing different cases or are worried about something, that ability to communicate in the virtual world and actually see things and do things together, just to see where you put your hands or this is how I would do this, this is how I expose it, will be a huge advantage.
Absolutely. That's very exciting. Gus, you provide us a really nice summary of the use of VR in the realm of orthopedic surgery residency training. And although your sample size was small, these early studies that you reviewed are really showing that there's equivalent efficacy in this technology as compared to traditional modes of education. And actually, a majority of your studies pointing to superior efficacy for VR. And as you state in your paper, further study is certainly needed. But this is really an emerging technology that can allow for smaller training institutions that may not have a bioskills lab, or like you said, international surgeons who may not have the ability to travel, to have access to a fairly highly effective training simulation. Did you have any other closing remarks before we wrap up?
I think that VR, as far as a practice tool, very rarely in orthopedic training do we practice. I think that's one huge advantage of it. I think, too, with the ability to put in the simulated complications will be a huge advantage for education. I think, three, being have an invited professor come into the virtual world with you while you're doing a case, as that expands, will be, they don't have to spend all the time. They can be in their, you know, their kitchen, and you can be in your kitchen, and the residents can be in their kitchen, and everybody can be working and learning without having to travel and do a lot of stuff. And that'll really make things more efficient as far as that. So I do think as this develops, this will be a fabulous thing going forward. So in the world of emerging technology, this we should follow. And I think that even from a small scale, depending on what company or what you use, I think making sure it has that ability to cast, in other words, connect the goggles to the laptop, that's a huge advantage. Because when you don't, they're all doing their own thing and you have no idea what's going on, right? Because they're on their own virtual world. So you have no idea. But when you can see it, then it's amazing. So I think that's a really a big advantage.
Gus, I think you did a wonderful job of highlighting the advantages of VR and also injecting your own personal experience with it into your remarks today. So I wanted to congratulate you on your work and thank you for sharing your time and your thoughts with us today.
Thank you, Chris. Great work by you.
Dr. Mazzocca's article titled Head-Mounted Display Virtual Reality is Effective in Orthopedic Training, a Systematic Review, is published in the October 2023 issue of the Arthroscopy Journal, which is available online at www.arthroscopyjournal.org. This concludes this edition of the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next time.